Well, good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
Good morning. Good morning. We have a beautiful spring day after nature tried to wash us off the face of the planet last night. Pretty violent thunderstorm. But good of you to come this morning. Of course, we have our announcements. The weekend at the very end of this month is going to be special for us. Please mark your calendar. Swami Nirakaranandaji of St. Louis, he's an assistant minister there. Oh my goodness, I brought the wrong glasses. Could somebody get me those little blue glasses that are right there? Thank you, Aditya. That's better. Swami Nirakaranandaji of the St. Louis Center will be here from Friday evening, April 26th, till Sunday morning of the 28th, offering us his wisdom about Raja Yoga. If you want to know the specific schedule and the titles of his talks, it's online on the webpage, and it's in your e-news. Seva Saturday for this month falls on the 13th. That's next Saturday, of course. Please note that date. It's the second Saturday of the month, as usual. Please join us sometime between 10 a.m. and 2 p.m. This is an excellent way to demonstrate your dedication to the center and its success. Of course, though Seva Saturday goes on from 10 a.m. to 2 p.m., you don't need to be here for that whole time. Whatever is practical for you. And if you're here at 12:30, you will receive some nice vegetarian mellow mushroom pizza. Next Sunday for the Christian community is Palm Sunday. Next Sunday, I'll say a bit about that, but the talk will be about the yoga of Christian mystics. So that's our announcements, I don't think. Oh, I do want to make another announcement that I hadn't thought of until just this moment. The bookstore, which is under the capable management of Sadanan, has been restocked. So if you've been waiting for something or thought that you might want to buy something that you've seen in the bookshop but it was missing, you'll probably find it there. It's all very nicely restocked. Thank you, Sada. So we'll start with our recollection of our purpose here and our relationship to one another to fulfill that purpose. Om Sahana Vavatu Sahano Vunaktu Sahaviryam Karavavahai Tejasvinavaditamastu Mavidvishavahai. Om Shanti Shanti Shanti. May the Divine Being look over us lovingly as a mother and father. May the Divine Being support and nourish us as a mother and father. May we have the strength and skill to study together the art of spirituality. May no misunderstandings arise amongst us. Om, peace, peace, peace be unto us and to all beings everywhere. And now Aditya Chaturvedi will sing us a song, and perhaps he'll take just a few moments to tell us why he's chosen this song for this morning.
So, I initially thought that I'd sing a Ram Bhajan, but since we'll be also, since we have been discussing Karma Yoga and mystics from various traditions, I thought it would be just appropriate to sing a song that puts in Thakur's message of Jotoma Padopadme. So, as many believe, so many paths. So, it says, Tu hi Ram hai, tu Rahim hai, you are Ram, you are Rahim, you are Kareem, you are Krishna, and you yourself has manifested as Allah. And then it says how all the religious texts are actually hinting at the same reality. And then at the end, the bhajan says that, please remove all the differences that we see because of our being as humans, and make us see that real truth.
Beautiful, beautiful. Well, last month we studied Karma Yoga, but April is our month, one of the 3 months of the year during which we study Raja Yoga, a spiritual path often called the Yoga of Meditation. A Raja Yogi uses ancient, proven spiritual techniques to quiet the mind and gain control of her or his attention. Regular daily practice of concentration may lead to meditation, which can reveal your true original nature and liberate you from the cycle of rebirth and death, which is the subject of today's talk, that liberation from the cycle of rebirth and death and the process, one way of thinking about the process, or process, as it's properly pronounced, eh? The title of today's talk is Self-Discovery, Self-Actualization, and Self-Realization. Self-realization is one way to talk about the goal of all spiritual practices. It is the entire focus of Patanjali's Yoga Sutras, and his sutras are the basis of Swami Vivekananda's book Raja Yoga and Swami Prabhavananda's How to Know God. You can think of progress toward realization in three steps. First, self-discovery. Let's define self. We're talking about two different kinds of self. As human beings, we have the reflected self, the sense of being an individual, separate being. This is not an error. This is simply a lower truth than the highest truth of our being, which can be expressed as the capital S self, that living presence within us that animates and gives life to the apparent self, as Swami Vivekananda called it. He has a talk in his book, the collection of his talks, Jnana Yoga. He has a talk called The Real and the Apparent Man. Well, we're talking about both in this self-discovery. So, self-discovery, self-actualization, and self-realization. First, self-discovery. What does it mean to be fully human? If you are bold, you begin to find this out during your student years and the early part of householder life, up to about age 30. It's a time of exploration, definition, adventure. If you're blessed to be a spiritual aspirant, it is also a time of breaking through inner boundaries and beginning to feel the living presence that animates you. Next, self-actualization. In this phase, you bring the talents and attributes you have discovered and the spiritual treasures you are finding to ever greater manifestation. From about age 30 to age 60, you unfold your career and also may have a successful marriage and bring up one or more children. This is very demanding and challenging. As Sri Ramakrishna said, a householder leading a spiritual life is the true hero. And he meant that very sincerely. If you read from page 126 in the Gospel, you will find what he means by the householder leading a spiritual life being the true hero. As you proceed with self-actualization, the sense of your interior self, your true self, grows. So there's finally self-realization. Sometime during that period of self-actualization, after you've been practicing spiritual disciplines for a number of years, you start to realize the life you are living is merely the surface appearance of what you truly are. You become aware that your outward self, no matter how accomplished or successful, is merely an expression of and evidence for a far greater being that lies within, who empowers all your activities, thoughts, and experiences. You begin to think of yourself as that living presence and to know your true original nature, in Raja Yoga called the Atman. So we're going to discuss all this in a little more detail. First, this business of moving from lower truth to higher truth. This is what Swami Vivekananda said. We do not move from error to truth. We move, if you will, from lower truth to higher truth. The apparent human being is a reality. It's a transient reality. It's a reality that arises and then passes away, as the Buddhists say. But nevertheless, as we sit here, we cannot feel that we don't exist, that this is not a reality we're experiencing. And so it's best that we deal with it in that way. As Swami Kripamoyananda once said to me, this is your satya. This is your truth right now. But one of the things that happens to us as we go, if we buy the premise of reincarnation, we grow a great deal of habits, we build a great deal of formalism about the way we go about things. It tends to be reinforced as we're born into a time such as this by our teachers, our parents, and so on. They teach us to be cautious. They teach us to be fearful. They teach us to be, and this is especially true now with children in school. If you don't do this, something dreadful will happen. You won't get into the right school. You won't get the right degree. It's very punishing to children. Very punishing to them. But we were subjected to our versions of this as well when we were younger. You're not living up to your potential. Whatever it is that's said, that somehow seems to minimize us. Make us small. Make us don't color outside the lines. Sri Krishna, in chapter 2 of the Gita, is very explicit with Arjuna. He says, look, fight, and parenthetically, the battle of your life. He's speaking to all of us through Arjuna. Fight the battle of your life. And what's the worst thing that could happen? You'll lose this Stardust spacesuit. If you lose, you gain the joys of heaven. And in time, if you're not finished with taking these suits, you take a new spacesuit. That's all. You've cast off a worn-out garment, a garment that... If you win, you win the joys of a triumph in this world, success, and all of the things that go with that. But the worst thing that can happen is we lose this suit. That's the worst thing that can happen to us. And yet we forget that. As Yudhishthira remarks, people know they're going to die, but no one thinks about it. So this is why I used the word bold earlier. In this period of self-discovery, and it's never too late to start it, if you've been stalled, so to speak, there's no reason not to start it at any time. This process of self-discovery was spoken of by Swami Prabhavananda in his first instruction for meditation. For those of you who don't know, Swami Prabhavananda was my teacher, my guru. And his first instruction for meditation was, the chosen ideal, and just for definition for those of you who don't know, the chosen ideal is that aspect of the divine formless or without, or formless or with form, identified as in whichever way you care to. As Sri Chaitanya says, various are thy names, O Lord, in each and every name thy power resides. So any of these aspects, any of these beings that have taken form or formless aspect of the divine can be your chosen ideal. So your chosen ideal is you yourself, no different. Learn to feel that living presence. And so as we go ahead with self-discovery, during the youthful time of self-discovery, the yamas, if you're familiar with Patanjali's Yoga Sutras, he starts off, the first two limbs of yoga are the yamas and the niyamas. We're going to focus on the yamas. During the youthful time of self-discovery, the yamas are likely to take a good deal of your attention. Yama means restraint. For most of us, the yamas involve first discerning, then actively working to curb those self-centered tendencies that keep us at odds with the world. As I said, we're taught not only by our past incarnations, but by our teachers, to think first of number one. Sure, we're taught to be charitable, to be nice to others, but basically, you're looking out for number one. This turns out to be a trap. So when you are, as a result of taking this attitude of putting yourself first, when you are harmful to others or the environment, and by others it means all living beings, where shall we go to find God if not in our hearts and in every living being, says Swami Vivekananda. When you are harmful to others or the environment, when you are deceitful, greedy, or selfish, immoderately sensual, or covetous, you also must be, to one degree or another, anxious, on guard, always seeking to satisfy one more desire. Because that's what arises for you. Why is it a trap? Living this life of the prodigal child may be fun in its way, yet it's ultimately self-defeating, both levels of self. It's ultimately self-defeating. Why? Because calmness of mind is impossible in that state of being. If you're always on guard, if you're always thinking, how is this going to affect me? If you're always looking for the main chance to satisfy some desire, you cannot have a calm mind. A calm mind is essential for spiritual progress. Not to mention an immeasurably great aid in becoming self-confident, self-determined, and self-efficient. Self-sufficient. Self-confident, self-determined, and self-sufficient. Why? Because if your mind is calm, you see more clearly. When your mind is agitated, you're constantly fragmented. Your stream of thought cannot be focused. This is why Patanjali says we start off with the yamas. We start off with curbing these tendencies to be self-centered. When you move into the self-actualization phase as a spiritual aspirant, the niyamas probably will deserve more of your attention. Niyamas are observances that focus on your internal world of body, mind, and spirit. as we grow, as we discover ourself, who we are, we learn, oh, I'm doing things that are not, as a spiritual aspirant, we learn we're doing things that are not productive. We learn that we're doing things that keep our minds agitated. And so we work to curb them. When we do that, this sense of there being something else within us becomes more and more apparent. When that happens, there is real encouragement to practice these niyamas as you begin to actualize, that is, bring into manifestation those both practical and spiritual treasures that you have found in your self-discovery period. So when you move into self-actualization, as a spiritual aspirant, the niyamas will deserve more of your attention. Niyamas are observances that focus on your internal world. Practicing the niyamas, you make daily determined efforts to eliminate all forms of inner and outer impurity. Not because you should, but because you want to. You see the folly of impurity. And so you are doing it not to be a good person. You'll become a good person as you do these things. But that's not the point. The point is that you will become someone who can pursue spiritual disciplines, spiritual activities, spiritual practices with greater success. So you eliminate forms of inner and outer impurity. You teach yourself to be content with the circumstances of your life. What does this mean? This means not paying attention to the advertisements on television. Swami Ashokananda in San Francisco once remarked, this was when television was quite new, and Swami Ashokananda was hearing from his congregation, oh, Swami, we don't find time to practice meditation. And once he thundered, and I mean thundered, from the podium, from the platform, don't tell me you don't have time to practice meditation. You watch television. So it becomes a matter of priorities and not distracting ourselves with those things that make us feel discontent with the circumstances of our life. Oh, I need a house with more bathrooms. Oh, so-and-so got that lovely new car. I rode in it, and it's so nice. Maybe we should get one too. It isn't true that he who dies with the most toys wins. He who dies with the most toys wins another lifetime. That's all. So, being content with the circumstances with your life. The third niyama is to prefer the good over the pleasant. This is something that really takes a lot of practice and is aided by meditation, because you see more clearly as you're practicing japa and meditation. You see more clearly how your mind tends to take the easy path, the pleasant path, and not strive to walk toward that which is more beneficial to you. So as you practice, as you are doing self-actualization, you're seeing, if I'm going to manifest these great attributes that exist within me, the practical attributes as well as the spiritual attributes, I can't be allowing myself to be drawn always into the easy path. I must use my discrimination, my viveka, to say, what is the better path? What is the higher path? And to walk that path. Vairagya means releasing your tendencies to walk the lower or just the level path. And of course, if we're going to be spiritual aspirants, we study sacred texts and we study ourselves. We continue this self-study that began with the Yamas. We continue this self-study and learn from our mistakes and our weaknesses. And finally, as you begin to have this sense of the living presence within you, you begin to do what Sri Krishna recommends in chapter 3 of the Gita. You begin to offer every aspect of your life and all it contains, including the results of your spiritual practices, to the divine presence. So these are the niyamas, these observances, these practices. As you come to understand that the living presence, that living presence is yourself, and it is an aid to these practice of yamas and niyamas, as you come to understand that living presence is you yourself, this prayer may become a favorite. It was one of Swami Swahananda's favorites. You are the source of infinite energy, this source within, that living presence within that you've begun to identify as your true self. You are the source of infinite energy. Fill me with that energy. You are the source of infinite strength. Endow me with that strength. You are the source of infinite courage. Inspire me with that courage. You are the source of infinite fortitude. Grant me that fortitude. So what are you asking for? Energy, strength, courage, fortitude. Imagine what you can achieve. Because as the great teachers of everyone said, ask with sincerity and persistence, and you will receive. You shall receive. So that's why I say this may become a favorite prayer of yours. You are the source of infinite energy. Fill me with that energy. You are the source of infinite strength. Endow me with that strength. You are the source of infinite courage. Inspire me with that courage. You are the source of infinite fortitude. Grant me that fortitude. And so the impossible becomes possible for you. Why? Because that divine being that is at your center is the master of the gunas. When Swami Vivekananda talks about the mastery of mind over matter, this is what he's talking about. And so we see in just the worldly sense, people who manifest strength, courage, fortitude, energy, what they achieve. And we also see it in the saintly realm. We see what can be achieved. As Swami Swahananda said, the only true measure of spiritual progress is change in behavior. And so this is why this actually works for us. It helps us change our behavior. And so we begin to seamlessly, this moves, each of these phases, there's no clean mark. It moves one into the other. You move into the phase of self-realization. In 1896, Swami Vivekananda wrote Raja Yoga as a guidebook for Westerners who had more than a casual interest in self-realization. pointing directly at the purpose that he had in mind when he wrote this book, the only book he actually wrote. Pointing directly at the purpose he had in mind, Vivekananda said, "Each soul is potentially divine. The goal is to manifest this divinity within, by controlling nature, external and internal. Do this either by work or worship or psychic control or philosophy, by one or more or all of these, and be free. This is the whole of religion. Doctrines or dogmas or rituals or books or temples or forms are but secondary details." Now, does secondary details mean not important? No, not at all. But they're aids. It's aids. It's like your GPS for your car. These days, with my vision, without a GPS, I wouldn't be able to get anywhere that I hadn't been before. It's true, absolutely true. But is the GPS me or the car? No. It's a secondary detail, one that is a very important detail. So we keep our priorities straight. What are we trying to do? We're trying to master our lower self, become masters of our lower self, so that we can use that lower self to manifest the higher self. Swami Vivekananda yearned, and I mean yearned. If you read his book, Inspired Talks, you see what I mean. Swami Vivekananda yearned for each of us to access the illimitable source of knowledge and power within, our everlasting birthright, and manifest our innate divinity. Raja Yoga, the yoga of psychic control, of meditation, and other special techniques, is one gateway to our birthright, one path by which we can overcome the world. We can take the inner subtle knowledge of cause and effect gained by Raja Yoga's practices and turn it into ever more perfect action in the world. As I said earlier, Swami Swahananda repeated to us, the only true measure of spiritual progress is change in behavior. In the Gospel of Sri Ramakrishna, the Master says, "What is beyond speech and mind, is born in the flesh, assuming various forms and engaging in various activities. How long should a man perform his duties? As long as he has not attained God. Duties drop away after the realization of God. Then one goes beyond good and evil. The flower drops off as soon as the fruit appears. The flower serves the purpose of begetting the fruit. But one who has attained perfection, realized God, cannot commit sin. An expert singer cannot sing a false note." And so the last phase of our selfhood is realization. And it's beautifully described, for those of you who would like to read it, in chapter 4 of Patanjali's Yoga Sutras. As I mentioned, we have available here, both in the library and in the bookshop, Raja Yoga, Swami Vivekananda's translation of and commentary on the Yoga Sutras, and also Swami Prabhavananda's translation and commentary called How to Know God. The fourth chapter very clearly spells out what happens if you do pursue this. If you begin to pay attention as you start the self-development, self-discovery phase, if you begin to pay attention to those feelings that you get, that there's something more beyond, behind this apparent person that I am, and then as you work to curb those things that mask the truth, as you do your yamas and niyamas, and you begin to uncover that truth, the truth of your being. The sense of wonder that arises when you begin to truly encounter this, because you see that it is not a personal possession. It is the divine being itself expressing itself as you. Saguna Brahman, Brahman with attributes. And the wonder that you can become in a worldly sense, in a spiritual sense, is beyond any of our present abilities to imagine it. All we can do is look to others. Look to those amazing people who have graced the earth with their presence. Saints and scientists and artists. Those people who have given full rein to that infinite power behind, as Vivekananda says. And they start by discovering those powers, then actualizing those powers, and then realizing their full potential, realizing the truth of those powers. It begins with being bold. It begins by being unwilling to be contained, by being self-determined, even if you make mistakes. This is the thing. When we're afraid to make mistakes, when we're afraid to go beyond what we know, what we've already been, we are on a treadmill or a hamster wheel. So we must be bold. We must be courageous. We must be resourceful. And we must not allow ourselves to be limited more than necessary. When we do that, what happens is not just an amazement, it is such a joy. Every one of those great ones that I've had a chance to speak with since the 1960s and 70s has looked back on their life with joy at everything that happened. Yes, we will have painful experiences. Yes, we will make mistakes and bloody our nose and skin our knees. But if we don't climb down out of the grandstands and get onto the playing field of life, Swami Vivekananda metaphorized this in his aphorism, first bread, then football, then the Gita. This is self-discovery, self-actualization, and self-realization. And that getting down out of the stands onto the playing field, he metaphorized as football. So that's my rant for this morning. You can't talk about these things without getting on your high horse, so to speak. There's no way to talk about this without exhorting you to go beyond. Discover yourself, actualize yourself, and then realize yourself. Most of you in this room have studied, in this room, that book, Divine Grace. Any of you who have a copy, I encourage you to read it again. Sure. Divine Grace by Swami Ranganathananda. It's all about this. That's exactly what it's about. And he, without ever mentioning Swami Vivekananda's aphorism, first bread, then football, then the Gita, it's exactly what the book is about. So let us go forward together, boldly, supporting one another, loving one another, doing what our opening prayer says to do, studying together the art of spirituality. So now is your opportunity, and please be forthright, be bold. What does all this mean to you? What are your comments? What are your questions? How does this register with you? This is the best part of the morning, when we do this together. No questions, no comments? Yes, please.
It's an example from Saint Francis. He said, "Where there is hatred, let me sow love." I use that example just to the road rage person. If a person is on road rage, we don't want to meet that person with road rage.
Mm-hmm.
We could just slow down, let that person who has so much anger or whatever it is, let him go, and then it calms down the.
Yes.
We calm down and we're at peace.
That is a perfect example, because we're all beset, as we drive, by drivers who are inconsiderate, even rude, yes. Even... So rather than get into, as Haima just pointed out, what we do is we think highly. We think... Oh, I am so sorry that that person is in such a state that they're behaving in that way. Let me not complicate the situation or exaggerate it by reacting. Let them go. It is what? A car length. So they charged in. So they endangered your life for a moment. And if nothing happened, nothing happened. You don't need to complicate it by making something happen. Beautiful example, Haima. Thank you. And St. Francis is just the one to quote.
Yes.
Where there is hatred, let me sow love. Yes, that's part of a beautiful, beautiful prayer. Thank you.
Can you give the example of driving, this literally happened.
Yes, it does happen.
Years ago, I was trying to make right turn.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a sign, no turn until, no turn on red,
mm-hmm.
until it turns green. So I was waiting and waiting, and the person behind me kept honking. went to his horn louder, louder. And he need not stop there. He came out of his car, knocked on my window, and asked, "Move." And I just literally showed him the sign. Look here. Nothing, no answer, no anger.
Exactly.
And that revealed the truth to him.
Yes.
That because, probably because he was so back, he could not see.
Or didn't care.
Or didn't care. Anyway, but in response to its wonderful topic that you discussed today, and interestingly, in today's HSC, Atlanta Journal Constitution, there is a section on aging and happiness.
Mm-hmm.
And in that they discussed, did you read that?
Yeah.
That younger you are, the more unhappy you are. And he is saying, according to the survey, according to the study, in your 20s and 30s, you are the unhappiest.
Mm-hmm.
Because you are floundering. You are trying to search, what is this all about?
Mm-hmm.
And try to fit in.
Mm-hmm.
And the second stage, he says, when you are coming closer to 40s, you are starting to what we call, or you call actualization.
Mm-hmm.
That you have found your niche, found what is for you, what is the best way, career-wise, the person you want to marry.
Mm-hmm.
All these decisions, in other words, settling down.
Mm-hmm.
And that settling down brings also, and Ramakrishna observed, very difficult, but that is where the beginning of happiness starts falling in place.
Yes.
But the ultimate happiness, he says, what we call realization, is beyond 40s and 50s. And very humbly, I testify to that. That when you are ambitious, there's something wrong. You have to fulfill what your dreams you have.
Yes.
And not to glorify self, but actually my best decisions in life had been after age 50. Because I knew by that time what exactly would make me internally happy.
Exactly.
PhD was part of it, but still. And people were asking me, why are you doing that? There is no money in teaching. I say, yes, I realize there is no money, but it fulfills me.
Yes.
Yes. It's my
passion. That's the imperatives of society are all about the markers of success.
Yes.
Money, status, fame, houses, cars, and so on. It's all nonsense.
And I would not say that I'm still immune totally to that. But this, now my question is, does this desire for spiritual fulfillment, does it happen in every case?
No.
Or some get arrested?
No. It does not happen in every case. And as Sri Ramakrishna points out very adamantly, it happens at the right time. When one is still enamored of the lower self and its attributes, you know, there's nothing wrong in it. It's just ultimately as Adi Shankaracharya points out, and it seems cruel when you first hear this, but he says it's nothing more than a way of committing slow suicide to pursue the worldly life. Because at the end, you're going to be forced to take another spacesuit. And what do we want to be? We want to not be forced We don't want to be yanked or pulled anywhere, as Vivekananda says. I don't want you to be pushed or pulled anywhere. But that is a matter of our own priorities. We never compromise the ideal. The ideal is liberation and realization. But we do not judge or condemn people for whom that has not awakened as a reality. And so this is why I taught this morning about these phases of self-discovery, self-actualization, and self-realization, always mentioning the aspect of being a spiritual aspirant. The spiritual aspirant will find something different in self-discovery. They'll find something different in self-actualization, and ultimately they'll find self-realization. Particularly if they really take refuge in the divine presence that exists and begin to rehearse that prayer about energy, strength, courage, and fortitude. Because it's not easy to overcome the world. It is not easy. This is why the avatars come, to share not only principles and practices, but the fruits of their own sadhana, their own spiritual journey, they can share with us. Those who drink from my mouth, Jesus said, those who drink from my mouth shall not taste death. Now, think about that as a promise. Think about that as a promise. It's just as great a promise as Krishna saying, turn to me in utter devotion. I see no sinner. Holiness itself shall transform you. It's exactly the same thing. And so we have these great examples. Swami Vivekananda said, this is the highest that our mind can resort to. We can't think about Brahman. There's nothing to think about. We can say to ourselves, yes, this is the most complete truth I can say, aham brahmasmi. Yes, but I don't know that until I have realized that. In the meantime, we can say, here is the example of a Saint Francis, of a Jesus, of a Rama. You know, Rama, the perfect embodiment of righteousness. Krishna, Sri Ramakrishna, Sri Chaitanya. There's one for each of us. You know? Each of these, if you look into each of these avatars, they have attributes that appeal to the different temperaments. Yes, dear.
Wonderful, you know, talk. And if the ignorance has been locked by the number lock, I feel like this talk maybe has helped align one of the numbers towards. I think I'm a little closer to understanding what you keep saying, that the chosen ideal is you yourself and learn to realize that living presence.
Mm-hmm.
Because we read about the great souls, we admire the ideals in them, and that's obviously an important first step. But unless we keep practicing and make ourselves to reach that level of the ideal, I assume that that's the goal, that to awaken that ideal within yourself.
When we recall that, we are not human beings having divine experiences. We are the divine being having human experiences. The divine being manifests us for its own purposes. And each, well, not all of them, but the Taittiriya Upanishad, the Aitreya Upanishad, the Chandogya Upanishad, they all have something in them that says, the cosmic being, the being beyond all understanding, at some point has this impulse to manifestation. We are that. That's what's meant by tattvamasi. And sure, it has its lesser aspects. But as Vivekananda points out so clearly in Jnana Yoga, you cannot have only an ideal universe. You have to have the balance. There has to be darkness as well as light. Otherwise, there is no duality. And without duality, there is no time, space, and causation. Without time, space, and causation, there is no universe for us to play in, for us to participate in. So this is what Ramana Maharshi points to when he says, keep thinking, keep asking yourself, who is this I? And you'll finally find it's the divine being. It's the divine being. And Nisargadatta Maharaj says, the world is so real for you because you think about it so much. Well, what's the corollary for that? Stop thinking about it so much and it becomes less real for you. Its reality changes. And therefore you change. And therefore the universe for you changes. As Vivekananda absolutely insists, the macrocosm mirrors the microcosm. You change, the universe you inhabit also changes. Doesn't necessarily change for everyone else. That doesn't matter. Though your changing will change the lives of everyone who encounters you. So this process of self-discovery, self-actualization, self-realization, it is the spiritual journey. And, you know, an attempt was made to particularize it and metaphorize it and make it clear what's meant. But it is nothing more than what Swami Prabhavananda said in his instructions for meditation. The chosen ideal is you yourself, no different. Learn to feel that living presence. And then his instructions on how to learn to feel that living presence. First, patience. This isn't going to happen overnight. Second, perseverance. Keep on keeping on. And the third, or the fourth instruction, the third of those after the first, is expectation. Expectation. I am that. I will come to know that. And it can happen at any moment. As Swami Prabhavananda also said, those of you who come here and stick on, and he made this little gesture with his fingers, those of you who come here and stick on are only a hair's breadth away. A hair's breadth away. It's what causes you to keep coming. It's what causes you to keep practicing. You sense it. I'm only a hair's breadth away. And the wonder is that the more you keep practicing, the more splendid life becomes. Doesn't mean there's no more pain. But even pain is transformed. Anything else? Yes. Here and then Sada.
Often mention about Swami Vivekananda saying first bread, then football, and then the Gita.
Mm-hmm.
But in a lot of other places, we see, like for example, Swami Brahmananda keeps saying that you should start practicing spiritual disciplines at an early age, and he goes to explain the benefits of starting early. So is it actually sequential, bread, football, and Gita?
Swami Brahmananda was telling us the ideal, if you start practicing spiritual disciplines when you're young and neglect taking care of yourself, you'll live in poverty. If you live in poverty, you cannot focus on your spiritual disciplines. So there's this element of great practicality in Vivekananda's admonition. First, bread. First, secure your position in the world so that you're not facing want. Want prevents you. If you're young and you do not wish to pursue the worldly life, if you do not wish to pursue a breadwinning occupation, then your resort is to monasticism. But if, as a householder, you must secure yourself, and Krishna says it in the Gita, if you can't support yourself, you're helpless and hopeless. So first bread. Now, we must understand that Brahmananda, most often, the teachings that we get, he's speaking to young monastics. Not always. But it's hard to find those teachings that he gave to householders. You find them scattered here and there. But most of what's in the Eternal Companion, for example, I would say at least 75% or more of what's in the Eternal Companion, he spoke to young monastics. So then football. If you're going to lead a householder's life, you cannot let the world master you. You must become master of the world. You cannot be one down to the way the world works. And as Krishna said in the Gita, it's not that hard to have worldly success. What does that mean? It means his energy gets behind it. If you're dharmic, if you're righteous, the energy of the divine is behind it. It wants you to succeed. After all, Vishnu is there. Sustainer, protector. And all of the motherly forms. We're not meant to fail. So we go forward and learn how to play the game of life, which is complicated, but it's not beyond our ability. And one of the things that, again, absolutely is true is we must not be afraid to make mistakes. We must, if we have an enthusiasm, and it's a pure enthusiasm, there's no reason not to do it, then we should do it and see what happens. Not say, oh, I can't, that might be wrong. We learn by doing. This is the field and the knower. This is the field of action and the knower. We learn by doing. So yes, we should start our spiritual practices. This is the second grace. Human birth is the first grace. The second grace is the yearning for liberation, which will lead you to spiritual practices. The third grace is a qualified teacher. If you persist in your spiritual practices and yearn for a teacher, one will arise for you. Siddha.
Just a comment. The examples Uma mentioned. And
Haima.
Haima mentioned, the note turn on red. And this is hers, and the other one was road race.
Yes.
They are excellent examples or metaphors of similar situations in everyday life. Certainly, yes, are like that. And how to overcome that situation is the restraint. You mentioned,
yes,
the amas in the self-discovery period.
Mm-hmm.
I should also say that self-restraint is also required to the next phases also, like self-actualization and self-realization.
Yes, but we learn how to do it best and most easily, yes, when we're young. Yes. If we start with the yamas when we're young and begin to look at our behavior,
yes,
what am I doing?
Yes.
Is this self-centered? Is this too self-centered? What am I actually doing here? This is that self-discovery. Who am I and what am I doing?
Yes.
And then when you get a grasp of that, then you begin to see all of the capabilities that are there. The discovery of, when you get all this other noise out of your face, you begin to see, oh, there are wonderful capabilities here. And so you begin to manifest those. At some point, I will give a talk on my late wife. She was an absolute gem of an example of these three phases. Her name is Marjorie Kemper, M-A-R-J-O-R-I-E, Kemper. You can look up her work online. She was a very successful writer of fiction, very successful. And she was bold and really achieved. Her teacher, her mentor, John Casey, if you know the world of fiction, you might know the name John Casey. Her mentor said she was a genius, not just because of the quality of her work, but because of the quality of her work ethic. Just one little example. One of her stories that went on to win a major award was published on its 31st submission. She had received 30 rejection slips for that story.
Thank you.
Before it was published, and then it went on to win an award, and unfortunately it was posthumous, but I went and accepted it for her. It was, she believed in her work. She believed in herself. As Swami Vivekananda said, it used to be said that a man was an atheist if he did not believe in God. I tell you, without qualification, a man is an atheist now if he does not believe in himself. And by that self, he meant the self that we discover if we do this self-discovery and self-actualization. Yes, there is no doubt that people can get stuck. And they may get stuck for a number of lifetimes. We must celebrate them along with everyone else, even when they honk at us in traffic. And that is so hard, when they honk at us and do... And you encounter them in the supermarket, you encounter them everywhere. Yes, dear. So, anyone else? This is wonderful, this discussion. Yes?
This is just sort of a question in parenting, I guess. On the one hand, children are being overwhelmed with this push to achieve, and if you, the fear, if you mm-hmm. don't do this. On the other hand, there's also a school of thought that some circumstances, the children are being given trophies just for participation, and they are being told, mm-hmm. oh, the world, is yours, and overly sort of coddled.
Mm-hmm.
So what is your feeling on the two different aspects and the sort of middle path, so to speak? How does...
This is my unqualified, this is the fruit of a lifetime's thinking about these things. Children need to be given more time to themselves. Not treated this way or that way. They need to be given more time to themselves and let them find out about the world on their own. Because when they're constantly educated, whether it's being educated that the world is yours and it's your oyster and here, have this trophy just for participating. Of course that's nonsense. It's a kind of nonsense. It helps some children and damages others. There's nothing you can do that is going to be unqualified success. But what I say is, children need to have more time on their own. And they need to be encouraged to take that time on their own and not spend it in front of a screen. Do you know who controls the use of screens more than anyone else? The parents in Silicon Valley who are creating those screens. It's an absolute truth. They are the ones who control the use of those screens with their children more than any other parents. They know the power of those screens because they're working with them every day. So whether there's any real way out of this conundrum right now, I don't know. Usually something has to really break before there's any major change. But who knows? Yes, dear.
I thought about that, what Prabha asked.
Yes.
I think every parent is, there's always evil and good in the world, but every parent has to take responsibility for their children to what, how much to watch, how, like a trophy thing, similar to that, like watching television or something. How much we allow them is our responsibility. We may be, they may call us bad moms at that time, bad dads, when we put some distinct rules, which is very common for the children to say that. That's okay. That's part of the parenting. You take those, but later on they will realize my parents did the right thing.
Yes.
But for the trophy, just for giving for participation, I don't know that it benefits. I think sometimes children seem to feel bad about it because they're just receiving it, not for winning or doing great things, but just for being a participant. That may encourage them, but those trophies don't seem to mean a lot with my experience with my own children.
How can they mean a lot when the child, in terms of parenting, Marjorie and I raised a son. He's now a very successful man. He's also a very successful part of the Vedanta Society of Southern California. He's also a disciple of Swami Prabhavananda. When he was growing up, he would ask questions. And sometimes, after I thought about it and thought about what I understood he already knew, I would say to him, you have all the tools to figure this out for yourself. Figure it out for yourself. At the time, it just made him purple.
That's right.
Or you could just tell me. Yes, I could. And it wouldn't do you a darn bit of good. You figure it out for yourself. About 2 years ago, in a very, very sweet conversation, that was one of the things that he thanked Marjorie and myself for, is putting him in on his own that way. Not making it easy for, but insisting that he use the knowledge and the attributes that he had. And that's essentially what we're doing here this morning, is we're encouraging one another to use the knowledge and the attributes that we have, to not stay in place, to grow and become what we truly are.
Raj has a question.
Yes, Raj.
I just have a comment that I think the one of the things very important in children raising, the concept of helping them to understand that whatever they're doing is not for parents.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. A lot of time it's like they project, and a lot of parents tend to project also because they say, I want you to become this and that.
Oh, yes.
Instead of doing that, even your studying is for you, not for me.
Mm-hmm.
Because even if you have to explain something, I found best way to work is sometimes when they kind of able to understand, then you say, if I'm in your place, this is where I will do it. It's up to you how you want to do it.
Mm-hmm.
Instead of saying, do it this way. When you say, do it this way, that means you're projecting, but you say, if I'm in your place, this is what I would do.
Very,
so you're still giving them open opportunity to figure it out.
Yes.
And I think that works best.
I think you...
Mind.
I
think then you, they take responsibility, accountability.
Yes.
And say, this is what I need to do.
Absolutely. Thank you, Raj. That's good.
Aditya has a question.
Yes.
I don't have a question, but I mean from my experience of growing up and being nurtured, so not parenting, but being parented. So one thing that I wanted to share was, so it's in line with what you said about giving trophies to students and kids even without achieving something. So I think the logic is to reduce the competitiveness or the idea that, you know, one might get depressed because they didn't win that competition. But I remember once I got the highest marks in class, and I was very happy and I was content. So though I mean they were very less, so like I had 70 to 100, so that was not really great, but I had highest marks in the class and I was very happy. But then my teacher told me that, you know, you have, Aditya, you have to compete with yourself. You don't have to see
compete
if,
with your,
yeah,
exactly,
with yourself.
Exactly.
So it's not about if everybody else is getting higher than you or not, but you have to always compete with yourself. And that kind of stayed with me. And then I was doing well in exams later, but I won't be happy because I was not reaching the optimal limit.
Potential.
Yeah. So, but that helps. But then I became marks monger. So, like, I was mongering for more and more scores. And a time came when I had 100 in almost all papers, which was in my MA, and this was unbelievable. But and still, I was not happy. So. It kind of creates that. I mean, it's a vicious cycle that you get trapped in. And then you have to learn to also come out of that somehow. And I don't know if parents really help or not, but yeah, it comes then spiritual. Then you have to tell yourself that, see, this is all unreal and you have to get out of this. Because there's no end to clinging on to what's being given.
You know, you said something so very important. All of what you said was very interesting and germane to our discussion. But what can the parents really do? If the parents let you know, really let you know, that their love is unconditional, that their love is not dependent. Raj talked about projection. This is where parents get into real trouble. They project on their child what they want that child to be so that they'll feel good about themselves. And so the child immediately understands that their parents' love is not unconditional. It's conditional on their performing to task. And, you know, it's a dreadful, dreadful burden for a child to bear. So what the parent needs to do is let the child know that no matter what happens, I love you and support you. Is this not the Divine Mother? This is, we need to embody that. Mm-hmm. And so, yes, dear.
I
In continuing for this whole topic seems to have shifted towards I guess the goal and the focus of education has to shift. Maybe, you know, in different times and different societies, it was needed to get those marks and to get something to so that you can get a job and earn a living. But when there's plenty and that focus is not necessary, then it has to be shifted for education for the purpose of learning, not for getting a job, so to speak.
Right.
You know, increasing the curiosity of the world around, questioning, discovering things of that sort. But even in affluent societies, it appears as if the focus is on get the marks, go to a good college. You know, that's where all this cheating is happening and things like that.
One of the most accomplished and interesting men I've ever known, his name was John Maloney. He quit going to school in the fourth grade. He came home and he told his father, "I'm not going to go anymore." His father, being an intelligent and loving parent, said, "Okay, I tell you what." Now imagine, this was back in the early teens of this country. So a dime was a lot of money. He said, "I'll pay you a dime for every book you read." Well, in their little town where John Maloney grew up, there was a Carnegie Library. He read every book. He bought Rennie's Daddy Broke. But his daddy paid up. You know, the Carnegie Library had a defined, you know, there weren't an unlimited number of books. But he read them all. He was a true autodidact. He was an inventor. He was a philosopher. He was, and when I encountered him, he was chief of staff at a worldwide, truly international soils engineering consulting firm. And the staff of that place was brilliant because of how he selected them. And so schooling, we need to tell the child, "I have confidence in your abilities." It's Einstein said it so brilliantly. He said, "If you tell a fish that the definition of intelligence is the ability to climb a tree, that fish will live its entire life thinking it's an idiot." Now just think about that remark. If you tell a fish that the definition of intelligence is the ability to climb a tree, no. The fish is wonderful and has its great capacities in its own milieu. This is true of every child. Yes, please.
I think all this discussion, what I'm hearing, is very much covered in when Vivekananda's mention about the football. Because the bread is first. Football really literally doesn't mean that football, soccer game. Actually, he meant by soccer, not football in Indian sense.
Yes.
Not American.
Right.
Though in American football, pretty much the same thing. Thing is, he chose
No, not really at all. Soccer is a very much more demanding game.
Demanding, but the way where I'm going is like, he chose it by picking a football. It's a team game. It's not individual achievement game. Not like tennis or some other. And in the football, yeah, you have to focus on goal of your side. But you are playing with a team.
Yes.
Sometimes you have to go back away from the towards your own side, pass it on to God to somebody, and see who can, as a collective goal, you are approaching with very much in the life, the same way, whether it's a parent, or child, or friends, or anybody else. And then, not necessarily you are the one who should be doing the goal. You may have to pass it to somebody who happened to get all the press and everything, oh, he's hidden with the gold, but nobody talk about the one who passed on to him.
Except the one to whom it was passed. They know.
Right. Mm. Exactly. So that's what I was coming in. The American football also, sometimes you have to punt.
Yeah.
But your still team goal and approach of Swami Vivekananda was like, that's how your development should be.
Yes.
Collectively and as a team. Yes. Sometimes you have to be down, sometimes you have to be up. Or whether it's a red light, traffic light, or whether it's how to educate child or something, he covered it very.
You're absolutely right, Naveen. The more you think about that, that aphorism, first bread, then football, then the Gita, the more profound it becomes. If you think about, what it means to be self-sustaining, to have enough bread, and then you begin to think about what it means to play football. That we're talking about soccer now. We're talking about that game. It is a game in which you have to endure such frustration. The whole game may end up 0-0 and decided on penalty kicks. And you've given your all every minute of the game, and yet you did not prevail. Your team did not prevail. It is such a demanding game. So, Swamiji's remarks, it's like he said of Sri Ramakrishna, any remark of Sri Ramakrishna, you could write a book about it. Well, this first bread, then football, then the Gita, there may be a book written about that. Because it is so profound. Only when you have mastery of the world and the world no longer troubles you, or you're feeling one down to the world, you feel like I'm able to handle this, then you have the capacity for spiritual progress. And this is why I recommend that book, Divine Grace, by Swami Ranganathananda, because he gives full flower to these thoughts without ever mentioning Vivekananda's aphorism per se. You can see it embedded in the talk, because the book is basically a record of the talk that he gave. Thank you, Naveen. Anything else? All right. Well, I know for a fact there's some good cake in there because I brought it myself. And there's some strawberries because those were brought also. And I think I saw a dish of some kind that Aima brought. And who knows what else there is. So if there's nothing more, we'll close with our beautiful imploring for Priya.
So I just had a comment.
Yes.
There were a lot of questions which was arising throughout this, your talk and then our conversations. So many questions arised and then got answers in the due course. But there was one thing which you told from Sargadatta Maharaj, saying you think the world is real because...
You think about it so much.
So then many questions came, so when I applied to that, it's so whatever values to me more, because I think the world has more, so that why there is a lot of questions and troubles and other things. So if I don't think in the same way, the world thinks, for me something else is more important, so that will give more peace.
We just have to make our minds for ourselves how much attention the world deserves in order for us to be content. Then where does the rest of our attention go? Because it doesn't take much, really, to have enough bread. Well, I notice that when I'm riding in your car, for example, and some other cars, that there's bhajans playing or spiritual music playing in the background. Let your mind reside there. Let your mind really reside with what's in that music. then there won't be any problem about if somebody cuts you off, there won't be any road rage, because you will be in that space where what they do doesn't trouble you. It's just a car length, and you see it that way. The fact that they did something dangerous, but nothing really happened, so there's no reason to react. It was dangerous in an instant, but nothing really happened. So why concern yourself? Why let your mind and your attention be drawn to that? So let it be drawn towards something that reminds you of the higher, reminds you. This is what Patanjali recommends so strongly, and it's a principle of Advaita, sublation. You're constantly replacing a lower truth with a higher truth. This is in, and the way you do that is to focus on the higher truth. You ignore the lower truth. You've got that. There's no reason for you to think about it anymore. So think about something higher. And so we proceed to a higher and higher manifestation of ourselves by focusing on the higher and higher truth. Ultimately, we will be able to say with confidence, Aham Brahmasmi, and then turning to you, Tattvamasi. Now we know these as two great Mahavakyas that embody the highest truth. Let us slowly and slowly move to where those truths are our being, rather than simply something that we know in an intellectual sense. Isn't this grand when we do this together? We hear from one another what our thoughts and concerns and questions are. It's the best of us. It's the best of us. Om Hari Om. Let there be peace in outer space.
Let there be peace in outer space.
Let there be peace in the sky, on the earth, and in the waters. Let there be peace in the herbs, the plants, and the trees. May the gods be peaceful. May the whole universe be pervaded by peace. Let that infinite universal peace prevail throughout my being.
Let this infinite universal peace prevail throughout my being.
Om Shanti, Shanti, Shanti. Om peace, peace, peace be unto us and to all beings everywhere.